Of this is the Gospel of Mark, which has currently three potential endings, depending on which tradition of text you follow, and all three the church regards, it seems, as inspired. Okay. And what probably happened there, presumably, is that the original papyrus of Mark or whatever, the bottom got damaged, and they had to repair it. A reminder also that what we're dealing with here is a foreign culture, and we're going to talk a lot about that tonight, a foreign culture. It's not America in the 21st century. They had their own literary ways of doing things. They had their own literary genres that had their own rules. They're not the ones that we're terribly familiar with. They're not the exact same thing as you would find in a television show or in a fantasy novel, right? They had their own rules. Just as we have our own rules. And we're used to our rules, so we don't even really register them anymore. We just read them and signify, oh, this is the right genre, and it affects how we interpret it. Like whenever something starts with a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, we're not going to interpret that the same way that we would interpret it CNN. We would trust it as being more factual. So anyway, that was a funny joke. Y'all should have laughed. Anyway. Okay. Anyway. What we're looking at here is we're going to be looking at human authors who are full human authors, and yet nevertheless their words are simultaneously the word of God. Right? That God in his magnificence, the same God who became fully human, speaks his word in fully human words in the scriptures. Which means that in the same sense that God made flesh had certain limitations, so the human authors are going to have certain limitations. They don't know everything that's going on, right? It's not like any of them had a camera. They didn't have a little recording stick that I have right here to be able to record people's speeches. They didn't always know everything exactly right. Sometimes, and I think we can all appreciate this, sometimes the human authors flub when they're quoting the Bible. Have you ever flubbed when you're quoting the Bible? The New Testament authors themselves, even though they're writing inspired scripture, Mark famously, like in the opening chapter, accidentally quotes something as Isaiah when it's actually from Malachi. So, you know, they flub. And as the great humanist scholar Erasmus said, God wasn't terribly interested in correcting their grammar, right? He was there to inspire their words so that the meaning of what they conveyed is the meaning that he wanted to get to us, the revelation he wanted to, for us to receive. But their grammar and their language and some insignificant details like that are, I don't want to say they're erroneous, I don't want to say that they're errant, because there is a sense in which the Bible is inerrant. It can't err. But the church says the Bible is inerrant in what it asserts, right? So in other words, in the truths of the faith that it is communicating to us, and in all the stuff connected to the truths of the faith, right? So it's not just going to tell us there's a Trinity. It's when it says there was Pontius Pilate as a historical figure, it means that Pontius Pilate was a historical figure. Do you understand? And when St. Paul writes the Corinthians, there was a real church at Corinth. Okay, but Corinthians is a particularly great example. When St. Paul says some of you are being baptized on behalf of the dead, that doesn't mean that he's advocating that. Right? He doesn't want us to do that. He's just saying this is in fact happening. Doesn't necessarily make it a good thing. Okay, which is what happens in the Mormon faith now. They took that one passage and get baptized on behalf of the dead. The point being is that to understand the New Testament or any scripture, but the New Testament in particular, because we have a little bit sharper lens on it, to understand the New Testament well, we have to always keep in mind that it was written by human authors in a certain context, in a certain language, which I'll get to in a second, and for a certain purpose. Now, the thing that the New Testament has that is far and away better for us than the Old Testament is that the writers of the New Testament are writing in a much smaller time frame. Right? The writers of the Old Testament wrote about events from the beginning of time to the Maccabean Revolt, but the authorship of those books stretched roughly from 1000 BC to probably right around 200 or 150 BC. That's still an enormous time, right? That's 950 years. The language changes over time, the history changes over time, the situation changes over time. This is an enormous difference. All the books of the New Testament, and this is debated among scholars, I'm a little bit more conservative here, all of the books of the New Testament were written in a window probably from 50 AD to 120 AD. So 70 years. That's one person's life. And that's all 27 books of the New Testament were written during that time. So they were also written during the time of one of the peaks of the Roman Empire. It's a time where we have an abundance of historical information. We have an abundance of context of what was going on. We have tons of texts that give us context for what the New Testament authors would have been thinking. In particular, am I getting to this now? Yeah, let's get to this now. Why not? I have a lot to say. It doesn't always fit under nice little subcategories. In particular, there are two texts outside of the Bible, two authors, many texts, two authors outside of the Bible, outside of the New Testament, that everybody who studies the New Testament deeply refers to. I'm not going to be quoting them a lot in this class, but I want you to be aware of them. Okay. The first goes by the name of Philo of Alexandria. Philo of Alexandria, P-H-I-L-O. Philo of Alexandria lived, he's a Jew, he lived from 20 BC to 50 AD. Can you imagine why we might quote him? And he lived in that great city of Alexandria, which we talked about last year, which was the New York of its time. The great city where a large Jewish population lived in Egypt, where they translated the Old Testament into Greek, known as the Septuagint, where they came into profound and deep influence of Greek philosophy. I'll talk more about that in a bit. But Philo wrote commentaries on numerous works of the Old Testament. The latest edition of his works that I've seen stretches to 6 volumes in kind of like Bible print. He wrote a ton. And his way of interpreting the Bible not only affected the church fathers, but is recognizably, used is the wrong word, but recognizably the same atmosphere from which Paul and John will also interpret the Bible. The way that Philo thinks about the Bible is the way that Paul and John think about the Bible, is what I'm getting at. Okay? And because he never became Christian, I don't even think any of the apostles made it to Alexandria by that time, because he never became Christian, we have him as a helpful extra-biblical Jewish source for how intelligent Jewish people were regarding the scriptures at that time. The second author, who is, if anything, more important, was an author who lived a little bit past the time of the New Testament, but he was a historian, and his name is Josephus. And Josephus wrote a few major works. Josephus switched sides from the Jews to the Romans at a certain point. He felt God was calling him to do that. It's a long, long story. This is not a class about Josephus. I'm not getting into it. But what Josephus does is he writes a history of the Roman wars in Jerusalem, which we'll talk about in a bit. And he writes a history of the Jewish people. And he does mention the Christians. And he also gives us a historian, he was a trained historian. He gives us a historian's lens on what the situation was in which Jesus lived and worked, what the situation was in Israel at the time that Christianity was founded. It's an enormously important resource, Josephus is, because there's so much stuff that the New Testament talks about that we would have to really just guess about if we didn't have Josephus. Because, with the exception, potentially, of the Acts of the Apostles, we'll talk about that when we get there, there are no historical books in the New Testament. That doesn't mean that there aren't books that convey history. It means that there are no books that are written as histories, right? That are written with the intention of being a history. The Gospels are kind of histories. They're also kind of something else in terms of the genres of their time. And we'll talk about that when we get to the Gospels next weekend, or next week. Okay? Everybody with me so far? I don't want to go too far afield here. My point being is that if you read anything about the New Testament, you're going to keep on coming up against those two names, Philo and Josephus, Philo and Josephus, Philo and Josephus. And I'm going to explicitly talk about Josephus some tonight. And I want you to know how important they are. You know, you can find their works fairly easily online for free. I don't necessarily recommend going to read them, but because they're long and complex. But if you're interested, you can dabble. Okay? All right. What else can we say about all of this? About the human authors here? Well, one question that a lot of people have is who wrote the New Testament books? And we're going to deal with each of those as we get there. There tends to be a very conservative answer and a very almost cynical answer, I would say. I fall on that spectrum. I'm closer to the conservative angle, but I will tell you my reasons why when we get to point four. Okay? I'm not going to go all the way back to like the way that we thought about it in the 1300s, but I tend to be more conservative here because I think that most scholars who write about this have never lived in a small town, but I'll get to that when we get there. Okay. Okay. So let's talk about the religious situation of Jesus's day. Because to understand the religious situation of Jesus's day is to understand a lot about Jesus and his context and what he was doing and the whole New Testament. We're going to start with the religious situation in Israel, and then I'll say a few things about the religious situation in the wider world. Start with in Israel. You may recall if you were here for this last year, I think I had this class, I don't remember. Kind of the most important thing in the history of the Old Testament, aside from Moses and Abraham, is the Babylonian exile, right? Remember that, the Babylonian exile, and how that changed everything, and how it brought Judaic thought into dialogue with Persian thought. Okay. And then you may recall, and we'll talk more about this in a bit, but you may recall that around 330 BC, Alexander the Great conquered the Near East and all of the Persian Empire and brought Greek language and religion and philosophy throughout all of that. And that influenced the Jewish people. And then in the mid-100s, so about 180 BC, you have the Maccabean Revolt, that a successor to Alexander tried to impose Greek religion on the Jewish people, tried to get them to no longer circumcise, put a statue of himself in the Holy of Holies. This is Antiochus Epiphanes. And Judas Maccabeus led a huge revolt against this. And there was an enormous push, and they end up winning somewhat. And one of the ways that they end up winning is by calling the Romans for help. Shortly before the time of Jesus, then, everything in the kingdom of Israel, in that state of Palestine had both names at the time, was influenced by the Maccabees. The Maccabees and their revolt and the order that came out of it was the thing that did everything to about 37 BC. Okay? We'll get to 37 BC in a second. The Maccabees had the kingship, even though they weren't descendants of David. They had the high priesthood, even though they weren't descendants of the high priest. And this was a problem, but the Davidic and Aaronic lines were hidden, it seems, and there's a whole bunch of mess that I'll get to in a second. Okay? From the people who come out of that mess, we get three big groups that are very present in the New Testament. Two of them named, one of them silent, but still very influential. The first is the Pharisees. The Pharisees were the descendants of those people who were rigorous about their faith and refused to compromise during the Antiochid reign. They were the rebels. They were the pure. They were the ones who kept the commandments despite all the pressure to give in to Greek thought. Okay? The Pharisees are extremely powerful relatively by the time of Jesus. Josephus estimates that there were 6,000 Pharisee leaders in Israel. Now, considering the population of Israel, Josephus is sometimes hard to tell with the numbers. Let's put it this way. For Passover every year, about, I think it was 2 million people came to Jerusalem. So that's how many Jews you're talking about in the whole kind of world. So 6,000 compared to 2 million is not a huge amount. But then again, if you think about New Orleans and its surroundings, including maybe a bit of Baton Rouge, that's about 2 million people. And if you had 6,000 leaders there, that's a lot more than you have Catholic priests in that realm, okay? So that's, you know, they were significant. What you should know and understand about the Pharisees is that they are, in many ways, the roots of rabbinic Judaism. Judaism, as it exists today, is the brand of Judaism that came from the Pharisees. Okay? So all the variety within Judaism today, all of it still comes back from the Pharisees and those influenced by the Pharisees. So they began the idea of rabbis, right? Rabbis. Rabbis are a Pharisaical tradition. Not a bad thing, but just so that you're aware of that. They were a lay movement, primarily, right? They were not of the priestly class. They were normally not aristocrats. They were lay people, lay Jewish people, and they were the ones who were in charge of Jewish practice pretty much everywhere outside of Jerusalem and its local environment. This is why you'll see Jesus interact with them a lot, because where was Jesus doing his ministry most of the time? Not in Jerusalem. The Sadducees are the second group that are very big. And you see them a lot for Holy Week, and there's a reason for that. The Sadducees were the ones who were the aristocratic priest class. They were connected to that line of the Maccabees that took over the high priesthood and the priests that supported them. And the Sadducees, very interestingly, rejected a lot of the Pharisees' teaching. This comparison is probably not fair. But this comparison is probably really not fair. But if anything, in terms of flavor, the Pharisees were much more like the Catholics and the Sadducees are much more like non-denominationals, except for the fact that the Sadducees were the priests and did all the liturgy and all that. And why do I say that? Because the Sadducees believed in the five books of Moses and nothing else. Right? You had Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Nothing else was scripture. They didn't believe in angels and demons. They didn't believe in resurrection. They didn't believe in the afterlife. They were like, unless you can find it in the five books of Moses, I'm not going to believe it. Which is why, you know, and I want you to start keeping these things in your mind and tracking them when you read the scriptures. It's the Sadducees that challenge Jesus during Holy Week and deny that there's a resurrection. And Jesus can't point to the billions of places in the prophets where the prophets talk about resurrection because the Sadducees refuse to accept the books of the prophets as scripture. And that's why he turns to when God says, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Not I was, I am. Right? And he is not a God of the dead, but of the living. So that reality is there. The Sadducees, by the way, are the ones who want to kill Lazarus for the same reason, right? Because he's kind of living, walking proof of a resurrection. The Sadducees, once you get out of their doctrine, the Sadducees have tons of money and power and were deeply in bed with the high priest, which was Caiaphas at the time, and the Roman government, which we'll talk about more in a bit. The last group, which is not named in the New Testament, which Josephus gives us the name of, and then in the mid-20th century we learned an enormous amount about that completely changed our view of the New Testament altogether, is the Essenes. E-S-S-E, there's a C in there somewhere, I don't know, Google it, all right, Essenes. And the Essenes were an interesting group that have a number of diverse beliefs, but it seems that at the core of it, the Essenes were attached to the Aaronic priesthood and were kicked out of power by the Sadducees because the Essenes refused to accept a fake high priest who bought the high priesthood. Okay? And the Essenes were driven to the outskirts of Jerusalem, and then a lot of them further east, they just gave up on Jerusalem, and they went to live at a place called Qumran. And if you are familiar with the Dead Sea Scrolls at all, the Dead Sea is not very far from Jerusalem. It's a good bit down, but it's not very far. The Dead Sea Scrolls seem to be collections of scriptures from the Essene community, and as we learn more about the Essenes, in many, many ways, suddenly a whole lot of the New Testament came into sharp focus. And the reason for that, and probably the reason they're not named, is because Jesus and his family and his disciples were very close to the Essene movement. And a number of things that the Essenes believed Jesus taught. A number of things the Essenes believed Jesus absolutely rejected. But there was somebody who seemingly, more than almost anybody else in the New Testament, from what we can tell from the Dead Sea Scrolls, had almost the exact stamp of the Essene community, and that was John the Baptist. And I want you to think about John the Baptist out in the wilderness by the River Jordan, which flows into the Dead Sea, and think about what I just said about the Essenes and the Qumran community. Right? Geographically, it works. The way he lived works compared to their scriptures and a number of other things. Now, one of the things that the Essenes were pretty famous for is that the Essenes believed in a dual messiahship. They believed there were two messiahs coming, one of the line of David and one of the line of Aaron. It is also possible, as I speculate in a forthcoming book, it is also possible that the Blessed Virgin Mary's family was very close to the Essenes. It seems that that's the case from some extra-biblical literature. If we put the pieces together, it seems that Mary grew up in an Essene family, which would make sense, because remember that John the Baptist was her cousin. So if John the Baptist is Essene, it would make sense that Mary's family was Essene as well. And don't forget that Luke underlines it really big when he says that Elizabeth was of the daughters of Aaron. Right? So that's kind of a rebuke to the Sadducee claim to the priesthood. Okay. All right. So the Essenes are there's a great book out, Jesus and the Dead Sea Scrolls, I think it's by John Bergsma, that goes into all this at great detail. We can't go into all of this in great detail here, but worthwhile thing to study about how the Dead Sea Scrolls really open our eyes to a lot that's going on in the New Testament. It is, in fact, entirely possible that the Apostle John was deeply influenced by the Essene community, and that a number of things that Jesus does in the Gospel of John shows him to be the true high priest that the Essenes were waiting for. But we'll get to that when we get to John. Okay. All right, so that's the religious situation. Now, there were 6,000 Pharisees, 4,000 Essenes, according to Josephus, and a few Sadducees, by which we can imagine like maybe a couple of hundred, who nevertheless were in positions of really high power in Jerusalem. Obviously, you're leaving out a lot of Jewish people here. Right? So, what did a normal Jewish person's life look like? Well, it looked probably fairly similar to the way it had looked for some time. And more or less influenced by these three communities. One other thing, though, that was very prevalent at the time that we don't talk about, that we haven't talked about yet, and yet explains an enormous amount about the reaction to Jesus, is that there were several quote-unquote messiahs and wonder workers and miracle workers wandering around throughout the place at this time. In fact, what you see in the Gospels makes that suddenly very clear, that Jesus is not seen immediately as the fulfillment. He's seen as the latest fad, right? And that's why he gets such a big crowd. Oh, he's the latest one doing this stuff. Let's go run and see what he's doing, right? And that's why the reaction to him was both, in some sense, very virulent, right? Very powerful. I mean, we got to shut this down. And also because it was that it didn't really even dawn on, I think, some people in authority to even consider that he might be real. He was just an instance of another crazy person walking around doing miracles. Which is why you understand when Mary comes to see him, right? They report to her all kinds of weird things about him, and she has to go check in on him, because she's hearing the same rumors about other people. Right. So, that's going on. Now, I would say that Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes function in a similar way. It is not a clean map, but in a similar way to the way that liberal, conservative, and traditionalist Catholics function in the world today, right? There are a few people who are really big in that movement. You're not going to find that in most average parishes, unless it's the priest. But nevertheless, your average Catholic is going to be more or less swayed by these different movements in the Catholic faith. Do you understand what I'm saying? And influenced by them. And so that seems to be exactly what was going on in Judea at the time. You had normal Jews who were nevertheless influenced, not necessarily completely under the sway of or completely of the party of, but influenced in their views of Judaism by one of these three parties. Okay? Josephus actually calls them philosophical schools, which should give you some sense of how he as a Jewish person conceived them. Okay? All right, is everybody good on that so far? Okay. The last thing we need to say about the religious situation is that Herod the Great rebuilt and expanded the temple in Jerusalem, right? and it was enormous. It was considered one of the glories of the ancient world. It was a wonder of the ancient world for a little while. And he, yeah, okay, good. I want to make sure I had that date right. He really emphasized the three pilgrim feasts of Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles. And so there was a huge amount of people coming in three times a year. And Passover was still the biggest feast. I want to say Josephus said the population of Jerusalem did something like quintupled during Passover every year. So more or less, except with a religious theme, consider New Orleans and Mardi Gras. All right, you just have tons of people from throughout the world flocking the streets. And that's one of the reasons why you're going to see such a ferment during the last week of Jesus' life, right? And one of the reasons why the authorities, who had more or less just been content to let him do whatever, now he's in this overpacked city that is primed for all kinds of stuff, and he's working miracles, and he's preaching apocalyptic preaching, and he came riding in on a donkey, etc. Not that Jesus did anything wrong by any stretch of the imagination. I'm not saying that. I'm saying we need to understand the situation, not to excuse those who murdered him, but so that we can understand in our minds why they moved so quickly to murder. Right? Why were they content to let him do whatever he wanted in Galilee and just hear about him distantly, but suddenly within a week they moved to murder him during Passover in Jerusalem? And that underlying situation of an overpacked city with a restless crowd is a big part of it. Okay. I think that's everything I need to say about the religious situation. Let's talk about the political situation of Israel at the time of Jesus. It's a very interesting and complex political situation. The first thing to understand about the political situation, I didn't even talk about the religious situation outside of Jerusalem, but it doesn't matter. The first thing to understand about the political situation is that the Roman Empire was in its first real days. So Rome had been a republic for centuries, had been an expansionist republic. Julius Caesar, in some sense, became the first emperor, but not in any real political sense that he had any kind of lasting power. After his death, after his assassination, there was a war between various people who killed him and also who were influenced by him. The killers of Julius Caesar, Brutus and Cassius, were put down pretty quickly. But then there was a civil war between Caesar's best friend, Mark Antony, and Caesar's adopted nephew, Octavian. And this war is pretty brutal. Octavian wins and gets crowned as Augustus Caesar. And when he's crowned as Augustus Caesar, it begins what's known as the Pax Romana. And this is a very important thing in world history, but especially for the scriptures. It might very well explain why God sent his son when he did. Because for the first time under Augustus, which is not to say Augustus was like, you know, Gandhi, but the first time under Augustus, from Spain and Morocco through to Iraq, down to the Sahara, and up north to the Rhine, you had one law, one peace, one empire, where trade and ideas and people flowed very freely. It was a time of unprecedented security and safety and prosperity in the Mediterranean basin. The Mediterranean basin is big, y'all. The Mediterranean basin is roughly the size of the continental United States. So that's a big area. during that time, there was, through a variety of political manipulations that I'm not going to get into right now, one of Augustus's friends, who had been very good, very slick during the war, and managed to become friends with both Mark Antony and Augustus. One of Augustus's friends was known as Herod. Now, Herod was an Idumean from Edom in modern-day Jordan. But Herod was Jewish on his mother's side. And Herod got named the king of Israel, which was a bigger place than it is today. And that happened in 37 BC. Okay? Everybody with me so far? Israel was kind of under Roman rule. Rome was very smart with this sort of stuff. Rome knew it needed Israel. Rome needed Israel for the same reason that everyone has needed Israel forever and for always, as I mentioned when we talked about in the Old Testament. Israel stands between Egypt and the great kingdoms of the northeast that come from the Fertile Crescent, right? It's the pass. It is the one way you can walk through without crossing through, you know, miles and miles of desert. It is the pass that connects the riches of Egypt to the riches of Syria. That's it. That's all you got. So they needed Israel. They also didn't want to spend any money on Israel. So what they did was they gave it to Herod under a kind of protectorate state status. He would run it. He had to be loyal to Rome. But he got the tax income, and he also had to provide for the services and everything like that. Herod became an immensely wealthy man. And I forgot to look this up. But he had plantations. I want to say it was persimmons. I forgot to look this up. I think it was persimmons. Plantations around Jericho that produced a fruit that at the time became the basis for cosmetics and all makeup in the Roman Empire. So that by the time of his mid-reign, Herod was the second wealthiest person on the face of the planet after Augustus Caesar. There's a reason he's known as Herod the Great. And that was because he was immensely wealthy. He did numerous huge building projects, built various cities, rebuilt the temple, built various forts. But he was also a little insane. And he murdered his wife, Miriam, who was the Maccabean princess. He married into the Maccabean family to get legitimacy. Then he found out she was conspiring against him, so he murdered her. But then he felt that she was haunting him for the rest of his life, and so he kind of got greater and greater paranoia throughout his life. He did some other weird stuff. But it didn't seem to affect too much his ability to prosper in this world. Now, here's an important thing for you all to hear. If you don't know this yet, it's going to throw you off magnificently. Are you ready? Who was Jesus born under? What king was Jesus born under? Herod the Great. Herod the Great died in 4 BC. Which means that whenever we set the calendar, whenever, you know, 500 years ago, they set the calendar of when AD and BC were, we were off by a few years. And that's okay. Jesus was presumably born around 5 or 6 BC, ironically enough. So, you know, before you get too mad at people talking about BCE and CE, just remember that Jesus himself was born 5 years before Christ. Okay. So Herod is in power. Now, Herod dies. We hear about Herod's death in the Gospel of Matthew. Herod dies when Jesus is very young, presumably under the age of 2. And what happens then is Rome, being Rome, still wants that puppet kingdom, but they were upset that that puppet kingdom was so dang rich and it wasn't coming into Roman coffers. Okay? So what they did was they split it among Herod's various heirs. And they gave these heirs different titles. One is called a tetrarch, which would make you think that the place was split into four kingdoms, but it wasn't. It was like five-ish, and then three, and then four for a little bit, and then two. Okay. One was named an ethnarch, which means the leader of a people. But for our purposes, what we need to understand is two things, both of them confusing. One is that all of Herod's heirs also took the name Herod. Right? So, and the New Testament calls them Herod frequently. So you're like, which one is this? Okay. But it's normally fairly easy to figure out because one of them screwed up big time almost immediately. And that was Herod's eldest son, who ruled Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria. So Judea is the region around Jerusalem, and then Samaria, which is just north of it. He screwed up big time, and the Romans were done with him. So they deposed him almost immediately. And because this was still an important place in the Roman strategic picture, what they did instead was they elevate, just like they had under the Maccabees, they elevated the high priest to political authority, gave him a council known as the Sanhedrin, but also gave him a minder who was known as a legate or governor, who lived on the coast in the great city that Herod had built known as Caesarea. Not Caesarea Philippi, that's a different city, but Caesarea, which was a major port. It kind of functioned as Tel Aviv does to Israel today. It was the bigger city than Jerusalem. It was also the richer city. And that's where the Roman governor would live. So Galilee, which is to the north around the Sea of Galilee, and was in fact a richer place because it had more water, a richer place than Judea and Samaria, that son of Herod survived, and his name was Herod Antipas. And that's the Herod that you're going to encounter for almost the entirety of the New Testament, certainly throughout the entirety of the Gospels. You have Herod the Great, and then you have, I think it's his second or third son, Herod Antipas, who rules in Galilee. And Galilee was a different place from Judea. Do you understand? It was not even like a different state. It was almost like a different kingdom. So there's a reason why it's a big deal when Jesus crosses south from Galilee. He's leaving a country to go somewhere else. We'll get to that in a second. There was a third and a fourth and a fifth one, but the third one that's important ruled out east over the more Gentile areas across the Jordan, and his name was Philip. And the only thing that Philip is important for our purposes is that his wife was Herodias, and his brother Herod took Herodias from him and married her, and that leads to the death of John the Baptist, as you may recall. Okay. So what you've got is you've got a Roman Empire that's fairly strong, especially during the time of Augustus. You have Herod the Great, who's magnificently powerful, but who dies a couple of years into the life of Jesus. And then you have these different archies, right? Ethnarch, tetrarch, etc., that are much less powerful, and one gets deposed, and you have direct Roman rule with a high priest. I know that might be a little bit for you to all keep in your mind now, but also you should be able to kind of map all that onto the Gospels. I hope you were able to say, like, oh, yeah, that's what happens at Passover. That's what happens here. That's why Pontius Pilate is involved at all, right, in the death of Jesus. He wouldn't have been if it had happened in Galilee. And that's why he also refers him to Herod Antipas, who is down for Passover, right? He's one of yours. He's one of your citizens. If I can push him off on you, I don't have to deal with it. And Pilate really didn't want to execute anybody. Not that Pilate was a good guy. Even Josephus talks about how the Romans hated Pilate. Pilate was not a good governor. He was brutal. And he got removed from his post. But Pilate's not dumb. Pilate's not dumb. If it's Lundi Gras, you don't take the king of Rex out and shoot him in the head. Okay, you're going to have a riot on your hands. And so that's why he was trying to push him off onto Herod Antipas. one last thing. One last thing about the actual politics of the situation that I'll explain, because it's important, is, let me ask you again, just to make sure you're listening. Why is Israel important? Why is it important? Right, it's a pass. So if you rule any part of Israel, and you know that that's its importance, how are you going to make money? What kind of tax? A toll. What we hear is tax collectors, and translated as tax collectors, or is more properly translated as toll collectors. Because you had a couple of major, literally two, major Roman roads that ran through Israel, one along the seacoast and the other on the other side of the mountains down to Jerusalem. And as you crossed every border, and there were a lot of borders, like I just said, you had a tax booth person there collecting the toll tax as you passed down, and however many miles you traveled and stuff. And it was a lot. A lot of money that they made from that. And that's why you're going to hear Matthew is not out at the IRS going around knocking on people's doors. Jesus just walks up to him, it says, at the customs booth, right? At the toll booth. That's where he was. He was sitting in the toll booth. He wasn't out banging on people's doors. Now, there were tax collectors who were different people, and those tax collectors, like Zacchaeus, earned a lot of money. Matthew was not that. He was a toll collector. Still very hated because, you know, a lot of people like me don't like to pay just to walk on a road. I say this all the time when I go up north, by the way. I am a free American. I am a free American, and I refuse to pay to drive or to park. It is my right as an American to put my car wherever I want without having to pay for it. This is ridiculous. Why do I have to pay several hours' wages just to park in a place for 30 minutes? It's ridiculous. Anyway, so I love St. Matthew, but I would have been mad at him too. Okay. Now, the political situation otherwise, at the time of Jesus, was pretty stable. There wasn't a major power to the east. It was going to come. It was coming. The Parthians were coming. They would come to power around the year 100, 150. They'd start becoming a major problem for Rome. But Rome was pretty hegemonic. It didn't have many threats, and there was a lot of safety. However, one major thing that we need to talk about, and this is one of the very few dates I'm going to have you memorize, is that in the year 67 AD, that's not the date just yet, but I'm just telling you, in the year 67 AD, the Jews revolted against Roman rule. And that revolt lasted 6 years. And that's when Josephus switched sides and went to work for the Romans. During that revolt, the Emperor Tiberius sacked Jerusalem, and in the year 70 AD, this is the date you need to remember, in the year 70 AD, destroyed the temple, plowed it into the ground. Didn't even do like Antiochus, did not put an image of himself, razed the temple to the ground. The temple has not been rebuilt to this day. That is kind of the thing for New Testament scholars. That is the date. Because as much as we would want to look at the life of Jesus and understand what's going on in the life of Jesus, New Testament scholars want to know what was going on in the time these books were being written. And they were written, remember, from about 50 AD to 120 AD. And one of the ways that they argue for when a book was written, I think sometimes less convincingly, is does this book of the New Testament show evidence that they know that the temple was destroyed? Because it would be like writing a Catholic book about the papacy, and you write many books about the papacy, and 20 years into the period of people writing books about the papacy, the Vatican gets nuked. Like, that's going to affect how you write about the papacy. Do you understand? Like, that's the level of event this was. For the temple to be razed to the ground exactly when the Jews were expecting the Messiah is an inescapable fact. It just blew their minds. It is why the Sadducees and the Essenes both dissolved, because they were both built around the priesthood. It is why the Pharisees are the one group that survived, because they were based around the synagogue and the rabbis. It explains so much about how the early Christians had a fairly negative view of Judaism, because they believed strongly. We're not going to argue whether or not they were right. They believed strongly that the destruction of the temple was a direct result of the rejection of the Messiah. And that now that you had Christian worship, you didn't need Jewish worship anymore. And so that's going to influence the New Testament. It's going to influence the early fathers of the church. It's going to influence a lot. Influences people still today. You can go and listen to people debating about Israel, especially non-Catholic Christians debating about Israel, and these kind of discussions are still very live, whether they should rebuild the temple or what happens with all that. Okay? So that's important. Now, let's talk about the any questions about the political situation? Was there anything I missed or anything you wanted to know? No? Okay. Let's talk about the composition of the New Testament. And the first thing I want to say is that, and granted it's small print, this is the New Testament. Well, technically, no. Let me say that first. This is not the New Testament. Thomas Aquinas is beautiful on this. The New Testament, which is another way of saying the New Covenant, is not a collection of books. The New Testament is the grace of the Holy Spirit given into our hearts. In the same way that God wrote the covenant on Sinai, now he writes it on our hearts through the gift of the Holy Spirit. That's the New Covenant. That's the New Testament. These are the books that bear witness to the New Testament. But we just call them the New Testament in an abbreviated way. Now, this is the New Testament. These are all the books claiming to be New Testament books that were rejected from the New Testament. It's quite a few. There are a ton of Gospels in here. There are a ton of letters in here. There are a ton of writings claiming to be by apostles in here. Tons of them. So why did these get rejected and these 27 get accepted? I think it's very important because the church has taught this a lot and scholars seem to forget this today. The early church accepted a book into the New Testament if it was written by an apostle or one of their collaborators. Period. Now, it had to reflect the faith of the church. That was one of the ways that they knew if it was genuinely written by an apostle. But their bar was it had to be written by one of the 12 or one of their collaborators. Period. Why do I say this? Because you'll find in a lot of New Testament scholarship that they just easily dismiss, of course, Matthew didn't write Matthew, of course, Mark didn't write Mark, of course, Luke didn't write Luke, of course, John didn't write John. Paul wrote a few of his letters. Okay. I understand, and we'll get to that understanding in a second. But that flies directly in the face, both of what we believe in faith, that these are the works of the apostles or their close collaborators. That's a teaching of the church. And it flies in the face of what the early church proclaimed. The early church, who would have been in a better historical position to know which books were written by whom. Okay? Now, why do people so easily say, well, of course they didn't write this, and of course they didn't write this? I think two reasons. I told you I'd be a little bit more
skeptical here, or concerned. Two reasons. Number one, people who are writing these things live in big cities. Okay? I'm convinced this is the major reason. Now, you may look at me like, Father Sinsat, what does that have to do with anything? Listen to me here. The early church numbered in the thousands. Only the thousands, not the tens of thousands. The thousands. It's smaller than Erath and Abbeville combined. The thousands. Okay? Are you with me? And you're telling me that not only did we have this many great geniuses who were named in the scriptures, but we also have a whole second set of like 20 people who were inspired by God to write New Testament writings, and we don't even know their names? That's not how a small town works. There are not that many people. You can't have 40 geniuses in Erath and Abbeville. That's not how 40 saints in Erath and Abbeville. That's not how reality works. I think they forget. They're like in New York. We're like, oh yeah, I could imagine somebody writing this at the university and nobody knows. But the early church wasn't a university. It was on the scale of Erath and Abbeville. You don't have huge geniuses writing works of profound spirituality and nobody knows their names or talks about them. That's not how a small community works. Do y'all understand that? And I'm not just being, you know, silly here. I'm being very serious. They have accidentally imported a model of sociological reality that does not correspond to the early church as it concretely was. The second reason is, as you might imagine, most people who work on the New Testament have also studied the Old Testament. And in the Old Testament, there are a lot of books that are pseudepigraphal. Right? We talked about that. Like Daniel didn't write Daniel. Tobit didn't write Tobit. But again, you're forgetting the shift. The Old Testament was composed over 950 years. The New Testament was composed within a generation or two. You're forgetting the smallness. Not you, the people I'm arguing against. You're forgetting the smallness. A generation or two? A generation or two, nobody's going to forget who wrote this book. Right? They're not going to say like, oh, yeah, that was written by Paul. And it was actually some other random person who wrote it. You're not going to forget that. Not in 70 years. I mean, somebody might forget it. One person might forget it. The community is not going to forget it. 40 years from now, I would be willing to bet that nobody here is going to say that Father Melanson or Father André Metrigent wrote a book on pilgrimage. You're still going to remember that I was the one who wrote it. Okay? I'd be willing to bet that in this town. And that's the reality here. We keep on substituting a big scale for a small scale. Which is not to say that every book of the New Testament is written by who we think it was written by or who some people thought it was written by. But here's where I'm going to go with it. Okay? I'm going to say, just so you understand where I'm coming from, I'm going to say that if people in the first centuries gave a confident authorship to a book, then I'm going to run with it. If somebody in the 200s said, John wrote the Gospel of John, I'm going to say John wrote the Gospel of John. If, however, as in the case of Hebrews, the authorship is debated from the earliest days, and only centuries later did it settle on, well, we think Paul wrote it, then I'm not going to say Paul wrote it. Do you all understand that? Do you understand my procedure there? Even the church now no longer says a reading from the letter of St. Paul to the Hebrews. It just says a reading from the letter to the Hebrews. Now, who wrote Hebrews? We're not entirely sure, but we do know it was one of the collaborators with the apostles. I have
I read something somewhere that's one of my favorite speculations, but we'll get to that when we get to